This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest James Corden was a star in England, but was pretty much unknown in the U.S. when he became the host of CBS's The Late Late Show last year. But now the show is nominated for an Emmy, and he's famous for a series of videos he does on the show that go viral on YouTube. They're called Carpool Karaoke, and each one features Corden driving a car with a surprise celebrity or celebrities, and together they sing along with songs on the radio. Stevie Wonder, Adele, Elton John, One Direction, Lin-Manuel Miranda, and Michelle Obama have all done it. Unlike most of the late-night hosts, Corden's background is not in stand-up or sketch comedy. He's an actor who co-starred in and co-wrote a couple of popular British TV series and was in the stage and screen version of The History Boys. In 2012, he won a Tony for his performance in the show One Man, Two Governors. In 2014, he co-starred in the movie adaptation of the Stephen Sondheim musical Into the Woods. He loves musicals, and this year he hosted the Tony Awards. Let's start by listening to a recent Carpool Karaoke. Corden drives to the White House in his SUV, and when he pulls over, the passenger door opens and Michelle Obama steps in. As they drive around the grounds, she gives him a tour.
This is the White House, and we're passing the Rose Garden, as you see here.
Yeah.
This is the Oval Office. My husband is in there somewhere.
Is he in there right now?
He better be. That's where he said he was. Do you mind if we listen to some music? I rarely get to listen to music in the car.
Sure. Well, what? I mean, let's see.
What you got?
I don't know. Let's see what we've got.
Crank it up.
Oh. Stevie. No way.
Did you know that Stevie Wonder is my favorite?
He's the best.
Like a fool, I went and stayed too long.
Every Stevie song on the planet.
When was the last time you got to do this, have a good rock out in a car?
Oh, I've been in a car, maybe it was months ago, with my daughter who learned to drive.
Yeah.
And she rocked out a little. We rocked out with her, but that was the only time in 7.5 years that I've been in
the
passenger seat listening to music, rocking out like this.
Oh.
So this is a treat.
This is a treat for all of us.
This is very much a treat.
James Corden, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, I can't believe that the Secret Service would actually let Michelle Obama in the car while you're driving and doing like hand choreography and singing at the same time. So my question is,
but why would you not believe that? Why?
Well, I secretly believe that the steering wheel that you're using when you're driving in the Carpool Karaoke bit is actually a fake steering wheel. And there's a real driver in front of you in the car who's navigating.
No,
prove it.
So basically, I'm in the car, mm-hmm. but every camera, except for the cameras that are taking exteriors of the car, every camera is fixed. So it's just a very, very small sort of 2-inch by 2-inch fixed GoPro camera. And there's probably 10 of those dotted around the car. Normally when we do that, we're obviously out on the normal road. So there's a car in front of me and then me and a car behind and then one car that sort of navigates around us, if you like. So essentially we're never driving more than 10 or 15, maybe 18 miles an hour. And you're sort of in this cushion of the two cars either side of you. So you're just sort of in an air bubble, if you like, really is how it feels when you're driving. But the one with the First Lady, we just drove around in a circle around the White House lawn. There was no other cars on the road, you know.
Right. Okay. Now I get it.
So there's no fixed steering wheel. It's genuinely me driving. I think it would lose some authenticity if it wasn't.
So was your car your theater when you were young?
No. I was very lucky in that I grew up in a house where my parents knew that I loved the theater, so we would try and go there as much as possible. So the theatre was very much the theatre when I was young.
Going to see shows?
Yeah, that was all I ever wanted to do. As soon as I'd been once or twice, I fell in love with it. So often all of my birthday presents, my Christmas presents, while my friends were getting soccer cleats or new football strips or Game Boys, I would get tickets to West Side Story in the West End or whatever. That was all I ever wanted to do.
And cast recordings?
Yeah, always. I had a cassette recording of Miss Saigon, and I think I listened to it so much that it sort of started to crackle out. All I ever wanted when I was growing up was just to work in the West End, really. That was my only goal. Everything past that has been as sort of thrilling to me as it is to everybody else.
So, you know, your show has become famous for videos going viral. And it's just so funny that in, like, the age we live in now, your TV show doesn't get seen nearly as much as the videos do. Do you know what I mean? Like, the videos have, like, tens of millions of people who watch them.
Well, yeah. The great thing about the internet is that it's a completely level playing field. There's no 10 o'clock drama. There's no football game. There's no basketball playoff. There's nothing. So our show airs at 12:37 a.m. Do you know what I mean? Our show doesn't even air on the day that we say that it's on, technically. So there is only ever going to be a small amount of people that are awake at that hour. So when we came to this show, when myself and Ben Winston and Rob Crabb, who are the execs of the show, we all we ever really talked about was we have this gift here where if we make a show that is good, if we make content that people want to see, we live in a world now where they will find it. So what we do is just try and make the very best show we can, knowing that if we make segments that are good, people will find them and people will watch them. So to be sat here now with, you know, we're like 16 months into our run on the air, to have like 7 million subscribers to our YouTube page and 1.5 billion views in 209 shows on the air is incredible. Like, we have the 3 most watched clips in the history of late night television ever on YouTube. And so what's great is that we just knew we had to make a show that would embrace that because of the very notion of the time that we're on the air, you know?
So you mentioned that you had done the 3 most watched videos from all the late night shows. What are those 3?
It's the Adele Carpool Karaoke, which I think is 120 million. And then a Justin Bieber Carpool, which I think is like 85 million. And a One Direction Carpool Karaoke, which I think is around 78 or 79 million, something like that.
Another bit that you do on your show is called Drop the Mic. And this is like a rap contest you have with guests. And the rap has to be just like really insulting, like you each insult each other. Sometimes there's 3 people and you're all insulting each other. And like, for instance, you told Kevin Hart in rhyme that he'll always be known as the guy who's not Chris Rock. And he said to you, "I fill football stadiums, you barely fit in the seat." So I want to play an example of what this bit sounds like. So here you are with David Schwimmer, who, of course, first became famous on Friends and was more recently in the OJ series playing Robert Kardashian. So here's my guest, James Corden and David Schwimmer doing Drop the Mic.
Millennials, let me introduce you to this guy. His name is David. He was famous in 95 because that's when he's hot. He was on TV then. Now it's 2016 and he has no friends. Get it? No friends. Not famous ever again. He was a Kardashian on TV, but that was only for pretend. You played Robert and that was a great combo, but you were so white, you should have probably played the Bronco. What I'm saying is, this battle's a blockbuster, so I'm sad. I know you're gonna spit something lackluster, but now you got the chance to prove you got while I ignore you like Jennifer Aniston does your calls.
A Brit in America is your one claim to fame. We all know as an actor your roles were all the same. The heavy best friend, the humorous sidekick with a belly so big you can't find your own. Dickens, the author we all read as kids. He's British like you, but people know who he is. You must be a masochist. You want to battle me. This won't end well, mate. It's not Love Actually. To be clear, I love the English. I married your kind. But why your wife chose you? My bad. She blind? Is she blind? Rap was born in this country. You're a tourist here. Do us a favor, James. Just change your career.
So, James Corden, who writes these?
We have some brilliant writers on our team who, I mean, the truth is, how that one with David Schwimmer came about was we had done it on the Monday with Anne Hathaway, and that was the first time we'd ever done it. And then our segment producer had a call in with David, like a pre-interview, to just find out some talking points and things like that. And he said, oh, I saw that drop the mic thing. I want to do it. And we sort of said, well, we'd very rarely ever do the same bit in a week. We rarely do the same bit in a month, you know. And then he was flying from New York to LA and had Wi-Fi on the plane. And whilst we were sort of going, I don't know if we should, these lyrics from David Schwimmer arrived of his like raps to me. And I read them and was like, right, game on. This is going to be a bloodbath. And that was it. And it was great, you know. So it's all a sense of all of us together. So I'll sit with the writers and go, oh, we should talk about this and we should talk about that. And then we'll find a way organically to make it all work. But we're very, very fortunate that we have some brilliant writers on our staff who are very good at this.
Well, when you hosted the Tonys this year, one of the things you did was talk about how as a kid you used to watch shows and think like, one day it could be me. And then you did a whole medley of songs from Broadway shows in which it actually was you, because there you were on stage singing them. And I thought we could play that medley. And what makes this even more fun if you're actually seeing it is that for each song, like, you're changing costumes. So you're not only singing these like really quick excerpts of songs, you're getting in and out of clothes, and it's a, you know, very funny bit. So this is James Corden singing a medley of Broadway songs from the Tonys.
Oh, there's no limit to the parts I can play tonight. I can be any role I want and no one can stop me. The hills are alive with the sound of trouble. Right here in River City, with a capital T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for people. People who need people. Ah, the luck be a lady tonight. Luck be a lady tonight. Tonight. Tomorrow. Tomorrow. Midnight. Not a sound from the pavement. I really need this job. How many people does he need? How many boys? How many? Candy and the sun's a ball of butter, and I am telling you that I'm not going. And the best man I ever known. Mama's talking loud, mama's doing fine. All the time, and how did it get here? 10 more years of stuck in the background. Here I am, hosting the Tonys. This time tomorrow, I'm back at 12:30. Sorry, I'm not entirely sure what happened there. I blacked out a little bit. Have I ruined it? I've ruined it, haven't I? I've ruined the Tonys.
That's James Corden when he hosted the Tonys this year. That was quite a workout. Was it your idea to do that medley?
Yeah. I was just thinking, well, what is it we want to do and what is it we want to say? And I said, let's try and do a song that we'll recognize that this is the 70th year of the Tonys and all of the shows that have been part of that. And mostly, let's make an opening for the kid in Nebraska or in Ohio who dreams of being on a stage, who dreams of one day working on Broadway, and to whom this night signifies the center of their year. Because I was that kid, you know. If you grow up in Ohio or Michigan, the chances of you going to Broadway to see shows are going to be very slim. And yet here for one night on network television is a celebration of the best of that year. And let's make a song that speaks to them in their bedroom or on their couch, and it ended with me singing a bit that said, to every future leading man who's making his debut in his fifth grade class as Peter Pan as pirate number two, to the theatre kids from any place with stardust in your eyes, of every colour, class and race and face and shape and size, to the boys and girls, transgenders too, to every Broadway would-be, don't wonder if this could be you, it absolutely could be. And we had lots of children on the stage, and then in a blackout, they transformed into all of the best actor and actress, best musical nominees on the stage that time, which is the first time the opening of the Tonys has ever had the nominees on a stage. And I'm very, very proud of it. You know, it's a difficult thing to do live. And I really enjoyed being part of it.
So I don't know if you consider this part of your roots in show business, but I know your father was a musician in the Royal Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
What did he play?
He played saxophone, clarinet, and flute. Yeah.
And was this mostly in jazz bands?
Well, he would be in the central band, the marching band, but then he also would be in the Squadronaires, which was a big sort of 42-piece swing band where he would also act as the compere. When they would play on the QE2 or they would do various events, my father would be the compere in between and would introduce people up on stage and stuff like that. So he's very funny, my dad. We've used them quite a few times on the show, and the more I watch him do bits for our show, the more I see where I get it from, really.
Did you play an instrument too?
No, I always sung, and then I used to play, we grew up in the Salvation Army, so I used to play the cornet and the trumpet, and I started learning the piano, and it's my greatest regret that I never saw that through. I don't know anyone who can play the piano who regrets being able to play the piano.
When you say
what I'm trying to teach my son right now.
Ah, so when you say you grew up in the Salvation Army, what does that mean?
Well, we went to the church we would go to at the weekend was the Salvation Army. So the Salvation Army is a church and a charity where you would wear a uniform and march through the town. Yeah.
To a lot of us, the Salvation Army are the people with the bells when you're Christmas shopping. And
yes.
The buckets for money. And a lot of us don't know much about the Salvation Army beyond that, except in Guys and Dolls. Sister Sarah was a mission babe, and she probably worked for the Salvation Army.
Well, she did.
Yes.
She was in the Salvation Army, for sure.
Yeah.
And that was the same. I mean, I have very, very mixed feelings about my time growing up in the Salvation Army, but it was, you know, it gave me a good, solid sort of rock. But predominantly, it's a church, and then is also a charity.
When you were growing up in the Salvation Army, did you play on the streets with your father?
Yeah.
So it's like busking for a cause.
Basically. I mean, it's so weird because whatever house you grow up in, for a very long time in your life, you just think, well, this is normal.
Mm-hmm.
This is completely normal because it's all you know. It's only now, you know, since I've met my wife and she goes, so hang on, let me get this straight. On a Sunday, you would put a uniform on. You'd go into the town. You'd get your instruments out and you would march through the town, and then someone would do like a sermon in the town square, and I'd go, yeah. And she'd go, do you realize that that is not normal? And I would say, do you realize that nothing is normal? Everything's extraordinary. There's nothing ordinary anywhere, you know? And no one's upbringing is normal. And if it is, it's probably pretty boring.
So did you like, since you're so into theater, did you like the idea of having like a costume to put on, a uniform?
And not really. I did not enjoy the Salvation Army uniform. No, because at that age, you just want to be on, you're trying to impress girls around that age. And nothing's going to impress a girl less than a Salvation Army uniform. Let me tell you that right now.
There's
a very real
true.
Reason. There's a very real reason why Skye Masterson is attracted to a woman in a Salvation Army, and it's not the other way around. No one's written a big hit show about the hot girl in town who sees a guy walk in a Salvation Army uniform and goes, wow, luck be a lady tonight, you know?
So in England, you were on some sitcoms before coming to the United States and getting to host The Late Late Show. And one of the sitcoms was called Fat Friends, and you played one of the friends.
That was a drama. Yeah,
it was a drama.
Was a long time.
Oh, I thought it was a
drama. Yeah.
Oh, okay, okay.
No, that was a drama, yeah.
And it was about a group of people trying to lose weight. And then
it was a six-part, hour-long drama following six characters who all went to a slimming club in Leeds. Mm-hmm. And each episode would focus on one particular person. So I played a character called Jamie, who was being incredibly bullied and had a mother who was a victim of depression. And then in the end, ended up committing suicide.
Oh, oh. And then after that, you co-created a series.
Yeah.
Called Gavin and Stacey, and I did see the first mm-hmm. episode of this, and you're best friends with a guy who is much slimmer and more conventionally attractive, and he, you know, your first time out together in the series, he's going to meet the girlfriend, which he's only had a long-distance correspondence with, and they actually meet for the first time, and you're kind of set up with her friend who is, like you, very overweight, and at first you aren't at all attracted to each other because you both, I think, have your own stereotypes about what it means to be heavy. And then you kind of hit it off and then things don't go quite right. I won't get into the details. But anyways, did you fear that your career was going to be defined by being heavy? And
No, maybe. I don't know. I mean,
and I should say, at that point in time, you weighed more than you do now. So
for sure, a lot more. Mostly, I felt like, yes, I felt like the industry is... I mean, the biggest time was not when we were doing Gavin and Stacey. The reason for writing Gavin and Stacey was I was in a play called The History Boys, which ran at the National Theatre, and then we went on to a world tour, and then we finished on Broadway for sort of 6.5 months, and the play won 6 Tony Awards and was... You couldn't get a ticket. It was incredible, and whilst we were doing that show in London, there's 8 boys of a similar age would come in every day with these film scripts under their arm, which would say, you know, Dominic would be meeting with Steven Spielberg and this person would be talking about this big drama they'd been offered and this person had 2 meetings the next day for something else. And the parts that would come my way at that point would be like the guy who drops off a TV to Hugh Grant. Do you know what I mean? Or like... Mm-hmm. The guy runs a newsstand in a film. And I was like, oh, it felt like the industry was looking at me and thinking, your talent is not important. We believe that you will only play these parts because this is what people want to see. And so it was very much a notion of going, well, we have to take our career into our own hands here and write a show where you can show people that the chubby best friend, if you like, can be absolutely as interesting, as beloved, as any other character that you should wish to focus on in a show, you know?
It must have worked because, I mean, you became very famous in England and the show got a lot of awards.
Yeah, it was the biggest comedy in the United Kingdom for a few years, no question of that, yeah.
It's so weird that, you know, you were so famous in England and you came here and took over the Late Late Show and Americans didn't know you. But it must have been weird for you to go from being like really well known from your TV appearances in England and stage appearances and then come here and you take over this, you know, important show and no one here knows who you are.
I found it rather liberating, actually. The only thing that was frustrating was not being able to get good tables in a restaurant at a certain time. That was the only real benefit of anybody knowing who you are. Your life is a lot easier if they don't. But the hardest thing is having 11 weeks to launch a show with a host that no one knows. So you don't have that sort of benefit of time with an audience, you know? Like most people that take on these shows have either been on Saturday Night Live for 10 years or they've come off a big sitcom or they've come off huge Comedy Central shows. And so there is already a history and a relationship with an audience that means you will have a benefit of time. People will give you more time if they already know you and like the work that you've done. We were painfully aware of the fact that we had 11 weeks to launch a show and we had to hit the ground running. We didn't have time to find our feet, because it was hard enough to book guests to come on our show anyway, because people would go, well, I've never heard of this guy. I'll wait and see what it's like. And so we really had to, I mean, I spent probably a good 8 or 9 days just driving around publicists' offices in Los Angeles and trying to tell them that the show was going to be a safe and good place, and that they honestly, we would love to have their clients on our shows, you know. That's where it was difficult, just trying to launch something. You know, I don't even know if I realized how sort of below zero we were. You know, we weren't even starting at zero. We were, I couldn't get in the building at CBS without my pass. That's how unknown I was, you know.
Is it like a dream come true for you to be in a car singing along with some of the people who I assume are people who you have great admiration for musically?
Of course. I mean, look, I never even thought I'd ever get to meet Stevie Wonder, let alone sit in a car with him and him call my wife and sing I Just Called to Say James Loved You down the phone. You know, so much of my life right now, I sort of think if this was an auction prize, it would go for hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, and yet for some reason I'm afforded the chance to do these things. And every single day I sit and I think, I don't know what I've done to deserve so many incredible memories in my life, you know, like at this point right now at 37 years of age, to have been part of so many sort of different things, whether that be theatre or writing a sitcom or hosting a show like this or driving around in a car with incredible people. I don't know what I've done to deserve such a existence right now, and all I'm set on doing is just trying to enjoy it, because that would be the greatest waste if I were to look back on this at any point and go, God, I didn't enjoy that enough. I would really kick myself for it. So I just want to try and enjoy every second of it, and particularly those moments. Because just to sit in a car with Elton John and sing Rocket Man or Tiny Dancer, it's ridiculous that that would be one's life, you know?
Well, good luck with the show, and thank you for being part of our show. Thank you so much.
Oh, what a pleasure. Thank you.
James Corden hosts The Late Late Show on CBS. It's nominated for an Emmy. After we take a short break, singer-songwriter Joan Shelley will perform in our studio with guitarist Nathan Salzberg. This is Fresh Air.